This year's fund drive is over, but the link to donate is still live at cgsf.ca/donate. If you missed supporting our campaign in real time, it's not too late. Donate now, and thank you.
What happened on October 7th with the killing of so many civilians was an unequivocal crime, a war crime, a crime against humanity, period, full stop. Nothing justifies it, and if we have any hope of preventing it from happening again, it is crucial that we understand why it happens, how it happens, and where it comes from. Otherwise, we will simply repeat cycles of violence as if those eruptions simply happen out of the sky. And they don't.
That's Phyllis Bennis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Phyllis Bennis, Ending Cycles of Violence, Israel and Palestine. The conflict between Israel and Palestine is in a new and extremely deadly period, with many thousands dead, wounded, and displaced. The battleground is the narrow coastal enclave of Gaza, home to over 2 million Palestinian Arabs. Often called the world's largest open-air prison, it is ruled by Hamas and has been subjected to an Israeli blockade since 2007. On October 7th, Hamas launched a horrific attack on Israel, killing some 1,400, taking over 200 hostages, and triggering the latest Gaza-Israeli war. While the media focus on the Hamas attack and the Israeli response, there is scant background or history. A closer examination reveals the conflict's deep-rooted causes. If they are not addressed, the cycles of violence will continue. As Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis says, we have to do the hard work of looking at context. Our guest today is Phyllis Bennis. She's an author and Middle East expert. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and directs its new internationalism project. She's appeared on PBS, NPR, BBC, and CBC. I talked with Phyllis Bennis in late October. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you, David.
Actually, I'm going to start with a couple of poems, one by Langston Hughes called Harlem. And I'm doing that deliberately because I think it might give us some sense of the current crisis and war. Hughes writes, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?" And the other poem is by Mahmoud Darwish, the national poet of Palestine. In a famous couplet, he asks, "Where shall we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky?" So whither the Palestinians of Gaza? Where shall they go after the last sky?
The two poems together are an extraordinary combination. They both speak to the loss of hope. I think the only question is, was there hope before this? Was there hope before October 7th? Was there hope before the escalation that we are now seeing? Gaza had been under siege for 16 years with shortages of food, of medicine, of electricity, of water, crucially of water. In 2012 and again in 2015, the United Nations told the world that Gaza would be, in UN words, unlivable by 2020. And 2020 came and went, and Gaza became unlivable, and the world did nothing. The world did nothing. And I think many people in Gaza, particularly the young people, half of the population of Gaza, Gaza has almost 2.5 million Palestinian people, half of them are below the age of 18. And those people mostly have never been outside this narrow little strip of impoverished, crowded land. They've never seen even the Palestinian West Bank or occupied East Jerusalem, let alone be inside the 1948 State of Israel, and let alone see any part of the outside world. So for those people, was there hope that was now smashed by this escalation? Maybe for some, but I think hope has been in very short supply in Gaza for a very long time.
Well, as our friend and mentor, the great Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said once ruefully observed, Palestine is a thankless cause, one in which if you truly serve, you get nothing back but opprobrium, abuse, and ostracism. How many friends avoid the subject? How many colleagues want none of Palestine's controversy? How many bien pensant liberals have time for Bosnia and Somalia, Rwanda and South Africa, and Nicaragua and human and civil rights everywhere on earth, but not for Palestine and Palestinians? He said those words in the late 1990s. Has anything fundamentally changed since then?
Absolutely. I'm so sorry that Edward passed when he left us in 2003, because the change had not started yet. But some of the things that he helped put in place, including the creation of what has become the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, it was Edward who taught us so much about what was needed at that time, which was specifically a movement, not just an organization, but a movement that focused on changing the discourse, the narrative in the United States. And over the last 25 years, we've seen an extraordinary shift in that narrative. Less than 2 years ago, about a year and a half ago, recent polling by the Jewish Electoral Institute showed that 25% of American Jews believe that Israel is an apartheid state. 38% of young Jews said the same thing. That's an extraordinary shift. 44% of Democrats earlier this year said they believe Israel is, quote, like apartheid. They didn't say it was apartheid. They said it's like apartheid. That's a complete reversal of the long-standing view that Democrats were even more pro-Israeli than Republicans. Bibi Netanyahu, in his years as the Prime Minister of Israel, and he's had way too many of those years, has transformed that so that now, unlike the goals of AIPAC and other parts of the pro-Israel lobbies for many years, whose complete goal was to make sure that Israel remained a bipartisan point of unity, a bipartisan consensus in the Congress. Well, it's not that anymore. And it's very much a Republican issue. Support for Israel has become a Republican issue. Now, that doesn't mean that in the context of the horrific attacks of October 7, the killing of 1,400 Israelis, in the context of all that, if we ask those same people today, do you think Israel is an apartheid state? I have no illusion that we would get the same result. But at any moment, a poll is nothing but a snapshot. It's a snapshot of a moment in time. What's significant about those earlier polls that I mentioned is that they have been part of a trend, and the trend has been consistent. We will see some ups and downs. We are seeing now a revitalization of the consensus in Congress, the notion that all but 10 members of the House voted for a resolution, completely one-sided resolution, saying we stand with Israel, essentially, regardless of what they may do in response to what happened on October 7th. And it's become very difficult to get support for a simple issue like a ceasefire on all sides, so desperately needed to stop the killing. This is what we need right now. And instead, we see Joe Biden's bear hug diplomacy that undermines anything he might say when he claims to show concern for civilian lives, anything like that. But nonetheless, I shouldn't say I hope, after listening to the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish and of the great poet of the Harlem Renaissance, but I do have a little bit of hope that we are going to maintain those shifts in discourse that make possible a shift in the media And that makes possible, ultimately, a shift in the political discourse, the policy discourse. We've already seen some of that. We have right now 300 former staffers for Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, the two most progressive members of the Senate, urging them, begging them, demanding that they call for a ceasefire, that they put forward a resolution parallel to the one that Cori Bush and Rashida Tlaib put forward in the House, to say we need a ceasefire now. We need an immediate ceasefire. If we look back to 2021, the last time that Israel assaulted Gaza, it wasn't nearly as bad as this, but there was still a siege underway, and there were days of bombing, and hundreds of people were killed, hundreds of Palestinians were killed. And at that time, again, President Biden was saying, we don't need a ceasefire yet, just like he's saying now. Not enough people have died yet. We don't need a ceasefire yet. And on that occasion, you had 12 Jewish members of the House writing a letter to their own president, they were all Democrats, saying, please, Mr. President, we need a ceasefire now. Please call for a ceasefire. 25 senators wrote and said the same thing. And then, my personal favorite, and maybe the most influential of all, 500 former Biden-Harris campaign staffers, the people who actually run the state campaigns and the city campaigns, who actually brought them into power, who brought them into the White House, 500 of them wrote to Biden in an extraordinary letter that talked about 73 years of Israeli oppression of Palestinians in an incredible moment. And at that moment, they were saying, okay, we need a ceasefire now. And what was so important about that moment, they were also saying that this meant they had come to the conclusion that it was not any longer an act of political suicide for a political operative in the Democratic Party to criticize Israel, that they thought they would still be able to get a job in the next election a year later. And they did. No one lost their job because of that. The sky didn't fall because there was this shift in discourse, this shift in narrative. Anyone looking at the press today would say, oh my God, the press is so incredibly one-sided. How can there be anything positive about it? How can we say anything good about it? Well, the way we can say something good about it is compare it to what it was 5 years ago. Compare it to the year 2003 when Edward Said left us. Compare it to that, and we see the legacy of his work, the legacy of all of our work, the legacy of our movement, is that there is a whole new, different way that the press, even now, has to approach the question of covering this. There are Palestinian voices. Yes, they are being suppressed in far too many arenas, in far too many places. But there is fight back now. There is fight back. And there are Palestinian voices appearing. There is the description of the horrific humanitarian disaster that is happening in Gaza every day on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, the lead story on NPR, the lead story on PBS NewsHour. All the mainstream elite media has to be covering this. They don't do it right. They don't do it enough. I'm not claiming that. There's plenty of criticism that needs to go forward, and it should be harsh and consistent. But we also have to recognize what has changed. And that's the only thing that gives us hope.
Talk about what's been going on in Israel itself in terms of internal politics there. This is way before the October 7th attacks. The New York Times, you know, calls the government's lurch to the right, with extremists like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich holding key positions. Israel was almost at war with itself, according to David Ignatius in the Washington Post, over the country's judiciary plan. Netanyahu was pushing for that very aggressively. So what's going on internally in Israel prior to the war?
Well, I think prior to this war, what we were seeing was what David Ignatius said, that there is an enormous split dividing the Israeli Jewish population. But we should be clear about something. There is a divide between the current coalition that's seen in the cabinet right now, which is a coalition of the right, the far right, the extreme right, and I use the term carefully, the fascist right, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, the two that you mentioned, of course, being the best examples of that, one of whom likes to call himself a fascist homophobe, another who was imprisoned for supporting a terrorist organization, a racist Israeli-Jewish organization terrorizing Palestinian civilians. So, yes, this is an extremist government, the most extreme there has ever been. But I wouldn't call it a lurch to the right that implies somehow that it was something other than the right before that. It was a completion of the shift to the far right. But it was also at a moment when the opposition, the so-called centrists, including what passes as the left in Israel, was fighting back around questions of support for the independence of the judiciary, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, a whole host of issues very important to Israeli liberals. What they were not challenging was Israel's occupation of Palestinian land, Israel's apartheid policy that has been so devastating for Palestinians inside Israel, in the occupied territories, and among the refugees who were denied their right to return home. That was never on the agenda, because the organizers of that protest movement knew that if that demand was included in the broad demands of the movement, they would not be seeing 200, 300, 400,000 protesters in the streets every week. They would be seeing 300 or 400 or 500 protesters, maybe a few thousand. They would not be seeing what the world saw, because there is not that level of support for Palestinian rights. And it's wonderful to see people protesting for their own rights. That's a good thing. But we should not have the illusion that that somehow was also designed to protect Palestinian lives or Palestinian rights. It was not. And in fact, some of the leaders of that movement included former prime ministers and former other government ministers, including those who were longtime supporters of the occupation.
On October 24th, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed the Special Security Council meeting. He, I'm quoting now, condemned unequivocally the horrifying and unprecedented 7 October acts of terror by Hamas in Israel. Nothing, he said, can justify the deliberate killing, injuring, and kidnapping of civilians or the launching of rockets against civilian targets. He added, it is important also to recognize that the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. Israel's ambassador at the UN has called on Guterres to resign, saying he's justifying terrorism.
You know, I got to say, the Israeli diplomatic corps has a lot of chutzpah. They really do. Not that they should be held accountable for what many, many public scholars around the world, including genocide scholars, that's a field, many of them Jewish, have identified as acts of genocide in the Israeli war that has gone on these 3 weeks, that they should not be held accountable for that, but that someone who calls them out for it should somehow be forced to resign. This is extraordinary. A population living under a military occupation has the right under international law to use armed force to oppose that military occupation. It does not ever, ever have the right to attack civilians, to kill civilians. What happened on October 7th with the killing of so many civilians was an unequivocal crime, a war crime, a crime against humanity, period, full stop. Nothing justifies it. And if we have any hope of preventing it from happening again, it is crucial that we understand why it happens, how it happens, and where it comes from. Otherwise, we will simply repeat cycles of violence as if those eruptions simply happen out of the sky. And they don't. We know that. They don't. They happen in response to conditions that become unbearable. Do unbearable conditions give people the right to attack civilians? Absolutely not. It remains a crime. And we have to understand what those conditions are. When we look at international law, it gives us important clues here. The definition of genocide, for instance, has two parts. Part one is there has to be a specific intent to destroy all or part of a group defined by race, religion, ethnicity, language, a host of other possible criteria. I think there's no question that we have that in the Israeli statements over these last weeks. The statement of a member of the Knesset who said, "We need another Nakba." He used the Arabic term. The word means catastrophe. And it's the word that Palestinians use to describe what happened to them in 1947 and 48, when 750,000 Palestinians were expelled, were dispossessed of their homes and of their lands, and forced to become refugees. Overwhelmingly, the population of Gaza today is made up of those refugees from southern Palestine from 1947-48, who ended up in the Gaza Strip as refugees. And that was certainly not the only statement. We have the president of Israel saying that, with as if it was an impossible thing to imagine, he said, "You want to talk about Palestinian civilians?" Implying that there were no such thing as civilians after what happened on October 7th, meaning when Israeli civilians were killed, there is appropriately shock and outrage. But he's saying the notion that there even are Palestinian civilians is simply not true. So we have these statements. Another statement from the president when he said, "We are not talking about people, we are talking about human animals." That's what he called the population of Gaza, the 2.3 million Palestinians, half of them children, he referred to as human animals. These are all evidence of a genocidal intent. The second part of the law of what makes up genocide or potential genocide is a set of five acts, any of which carried out with that specific intent makes it genocide. It turns it from mere ethnic cleansing, the action, into genocide when the intention is against the whole group. Israel is now carrying out three of those five: killing members of the group, wounding or injuring members of the group, either mentally or physically, and creating conditions that make life as a group impossible, such as a siege where water and food and medicine and electricity are denied. Those three things together are all among the criteria for determining what is genocide. Add that to the clear genocidal intent, and you have something that the International Criminal Court should be investigating right now. They should be calling it out right now and saying, if Israel continues these actions based on these statements they have already made, this places Israeli officials, military as well as political officials, in danger of being indicted in this court for genocide, for the act of genocide. And I don't see that happening. But I think that's what the world needs to be demanding. First up, we need to be continuing to demand a ceasefire. We desperately need a ceasefire right now. None of the aid in sufficient amounts will be able to get in if the bombing continues. These little caravans of 3 trucks, 7 trucks, 15 trucks is enough to feed the people that are hanging out at the Rafah crossing trying to get out for 2 days. It's almost nothing relative to what's needed. The hospitals, 3/4 of them have already announced they're shutting down because they have no water, they have no fuel for their generators, they have no electricity, and many of their doctors and nurses have been killed. 75 of the ambulance drivers, EMTs, emergency workers, have been killed. All of the ambulance services have now announced they can't send ambulances to help anyone who is injured, anyone who is caught under a building. They're on their own. There is no help to come.
The term genocide was coined by a Polish Jew, a famous jurist, a lawyer, Raphael Lemkin. Having seen what the Turks did to the Armenians in 1915 and then the Holocaust. Now, there's an Israeli historian of genocide. His name is Raz Siegel. And in the issue of Jewish Currents, he calls Israel's assault on Gaza a textbook case of genocide.
And he's not the only one. There is a petition that has been signed, I don't know how many, I think it's over 100 scholars around the world, scholars of genocide. That's an academic discipline, hard to imagine, but it is. And they are the ones who understand better than anyone what international law actually says and doesn't say about defining genocide, holding accountable those accused of acts of genocide, and crucially, the obligations of, in this case, the member states who have signed the Convention Against Genocide, which include, of course, the United States and Israel. Any outside third party who is a signatory to that convention has an international obligation to act to stop it. So what is our government doing? We are not only sending Israel $3.8 billion every year as a starting amount, it's already this year up way over $4 billion, but we are now just announcing $14 billion that the Biden administration wants to send for this war. So we are paying for this war. Israel's entire military budget is $23 billion. When this $14 billion goes through, and there's little doubt that it will mean that the United States taxpayers are paying more than 75% of Israel's entire military budget this year. That's shocking. For a government that is carrying out acts that are at best war crimes and may well be crimes against humanity and acts of genocide. We are culpable. Our government is accountable, and we as taxpayers have to do even more to say, not in our name, we need a ceasefire now. This is the necessity to stop the killing. Will a ceasefire solve all the problems? Of course not. We also need humanitarian aid. We need accountability for all of the crimes, including the crimes of October 7th. We need all of that. We need the hostages to be freed. It's now over 10,000 Palestinians being held illegally in Israeli jails. We need them to be freed. 160 of them are children. So it's a shocking reality. And we need to keep up the pressure. There was a piece in the New York Times today saying that the Biden administration is feeling the pressure from a divided Democratic Party. One of the biggest divides is between the Democratic electeds, who still, I think, are living in a bubble, thinking somehow it's political suicide, is what their base does not want to criticize Israel. That's just not the case. It hasn't been the case for a long time, but it's really not the case now. And yet, we're seeing this enormous divide between the Democratic Party base and those elected by the Democrats on this issue, among other issues. There's plenty of issues where there's a divide, but this one may be more dramatic than any because there's such passion around stopping it, because we are seeing in real time what this war looks like. We are seeing genocide beginning to take place. This is not a warning that Israel might do something. This is it. They are doing it. With the water cut off in Gaza, we are very soon going to be seeing waterborne diseases adding to the triggers of death. It's not only going to be people who are dying of thirst, but people are going to be dying of cholera and other waterborne diseases. And who's going to die first? The babies, the children, and the elders, because they're the most vulnerable. And we are watching it happen in real time. We're watching it on our screens. The first thing that people in Gaza are doing when they get a moment of electrical outlet from somebody, from a car that somebody starts and the battery is available, people charge their phones so they can send word to their families to say we're still alive, and to the world to say stop it.
You're listening to Phyllis Bennis, Ending Cycles of Violence, Israel and Palestine. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Talk about Hamas and describe, you know, what kind of organization it is. It won an election in 2006. It takes power in Gaza in the following year. It has ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. But what level of support does it have among